These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century and now 21st century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello there, this is episode 70 of the Target Files, where we're discussing Doctor Who Dalek Invasion of Earth, written by Terence Dix, and the audiobook narrated by William Russell. Hello, this is Alex in a very hot Exeter.
And this is Mike in a very hot Swansea. Hello.
Hello, so Mike, what did we think of it? As you know, it's a bit of an interesting one. This is, I think, the audiobook and the Target book are the only things that sort of survive it, aren't they?
No, we do have all six episodes, Al.
We do, because I wasn't too sure.
Yeah, no, we were talking about Master Plan a minute ago, and that's mainly missing, I think, nine out of
that's the one I was thinking of. I just had a look now, you can get the Isle there, so that hopefully be on a Blu-ray at some point.
And hopefully, it's already on Blu-ray in terms of the Peter Cushing movie, of course, which is the sequel.
Of course, yeah, that one, that's the one I've been thinking of,
No worries. Yes, my initial thoughts, Al, action... Very slow burn in terms of tension. The Doctor seems to take a bit of a backseat throughout, but I think that's to set up the very first departure of one of his companions at the end.
I think it works really well. I agree that sort of slow build-up of tension works really well, and you do have that sort of the Doctor not being the main character, because there's so many other sort of characters around, like the survivors, and you know, the companions are really strong characters, you know, Barbara and Susan. Building up to the, you know, one of the main characters leaving, I think works really well, really.
One of the middle stories of season two of Doctor Who back in 1964, this adventure. Ian, Barbara, Susan, the TARDIS team, of course, arrive in London on a 22nd century Earth, isn't it?
It's a sort of Earth, what sort of semi looks the same, but it's complete sort of wasteland by the time they get there, really.
Yeah, somewhere in the London Docklands, we think they materialise, don't they?
Yeah, it sort of looks like a sort of semi, sort of demolished sort of building site, you know, sort of Canary Wharf sort of building site when they get there. As we know, there's that great twist what comes very quickly that this is not nice, it's not safe.
Not exactly as it seems. No, quite a slow build-up, but well written by David Whittaker in the TV version. Al, I didn't get a chance to watch that six-parter again, but it has been noted for its slow pace at times. But I think Terence Dix published this in 1977 through Target, and he certainly added a great deal more tension and increased the pace a little bit, I think.
Oh, definitely. I think the pace is sort of improved, because I haven't seen those episodes of what I've seen in the past, and they are a bit slow. It's one that could have been cut easily down to about three or four episodes, which I think is what, you know, we eventually got, where the four-episode story was the, you know, the main thing that worked. So, I think it's good. I think it works very well, the book, and I think, you know, this is one of Terence Dix's very good books. I think he does a lot with that sort of making something a bit more tense that was a bit strung out in the episodes, I think.
Yes, he's able to do that both with his own scripts, isn't he, and the ones he's borrowed from the earlier production teams.
On a recent interview on the Tom Baker Blu-ray, which is about the whole Target books, he does say he did become formulaic, he did use tricks, you know, language and word-wise, but I think this book has enough of the pace and the action to keep you really enjoying it, I think.
Yes, not seen that interview yet myself, Al, but does he mention, as he did when I saw him speak live a few years ago, that he was more or less churning them out for the money during the mid sort of period of the Target books?
Doesn't actually say that, but he does say that he always had, you know, certain expressions, what he basically worked out work. So every book, you know, these expressions would be there, you know, the whole whining, wheezing noise of the TARDIS. That was a trick he learned that, you know, once it worked, not to change it, basically, I think.
Yes, you know, lines such as wheezing, groaning sound, that was, of course, brought up in the 50th, the Day of the Doctor.
Yeah, and this whole, you know, I don't think it works, it's not about this Doctor, but the whole, you know, the cricket face thing you did for Peter Davison that was mentioned in that documentary, and these sort of tricks of language he likes, basically, and, you know, looking at ways of getting particular wordage in, basically. I think it's Terence's sort of stance, I think.
Yes, not a huge deal of expansion, which we can know he can do so well in this particular Target adaptation. On the other side of Terence's skill and flair as a writer, there is something missing in terms of the drama of certain scenes, certain situations in this book. As you've alluded to already, the initial iconic moment of a Dalek appearing from the Thames. Do you think that loses a little bit? Certainly on the page, I think. They bring it in with dramatic music, and William Russell narrates it very dramatically in the audiobook.
Yeah, I still think it loses even the audiobook, even though there is that great music and the way William Russell would narrate it. I still think it's sort of blink and you miss it moment, where, you know, it's a really seminal moment in the actual episode, and it's sort of, oh, there's a Dalek that comes out of the sea, and it's obviously, you know, the Thames, and it's like, oh, Daleks are here, sort of. It doesn't that seem to have that real sort of scary Dalek moment. I think it does have in the TV episodes.
And what did you make of the concept of the Robo-Men, almost a prototype for the Cybermen?
Yeah, they're really interesting. The fact, you know, well, you know, the Daleks obviously need somebody, you know, people to control and do all the sort of grunt work. So they turn people into cybernetic sort of people who have no control. And I think the way that, you know, they eventually the people trick the Daleks by making them think they're robots when they're not, basically. You know, it's like the Doctor does it and other people do it. The sort of way you can be tricked into thinking that this sort of cybernetic thing is good when it isn't, really.
Yes, a good bit of human ingenuity there, of course, but you do wonder in the modern series whether, you know, the Daleks would have all sorts of technology and scanners and they'd be able to read emotions and tell when people are lying and, you know, the various telltale signs of lying and whether that would work in a modern story.
Well, I think it does because I think it was in the Paul McGann Doom Coalition 4 where they, or Doom Coalition 2, I think it is, where they try that trick on the Doctor and he still manages to persuade them that he's a robo when he isn't, basically. So I think it does still work.
Aha, got those tricks up the sleeve. That's a big Finnish production, isn't it, Doom Coalition?
Yeah. I think it's the Doom Coalition box set 2, I think. They try that trick in when Paul McGann's Doctor meets the Daleks and that. And that sort of trick of being a robo still works from him. They can't tell. So I think it still works. Well, I think, yeah, I agree. It'd probably be technology in the TV where they work out, you know, it's not a real robo.
Yes, and moving on to some of the characters, a very sort of likeable bunch of freedom fighters we come across, don't we?
Well, most of them are quite positive. I don't know if it's because of the time. All the blokes are quite positive and happy, and some want to find their family have been captured, and some are there just to fight and make big bombs. I thought the woman freedom fighter was a bit too realistic sometimes. He's sort of very down, depressed. Well, that's probably because of her situation, I suppose.
Yes, and the man sort of always being positive and taking the lead. You know, Barbara stands up very forthrightly in this book because she's a good female character.
Yeah, I think the female character, Barbara and Susan and the Freedom Fighters, name just got out of my head, but I think they're very well put forward and they're very strong. And, you know, there's that great bit with the dust cart in the later chapters where, you know, they're doing these sort of big sort of scenes that they probably wouldn't have done before. Well, I just don't know if she comes over very well, the sort of, you know, the person who's sort of telling all the other people, oh, yeah, they're all going, oh, we're going to win, we're going to beat the Daleks. And she's like, no, you're not. So I don't know if it's a bit downtrodden, maybe.
You quite often need that foil, whether it's male or female, really, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helps the sort of drama move along, I think.
Jenny is that character, I think, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. That's right.
But, you know, what you said about the dust carts and driving the old vans around, there's very sort of evocative language from Terence Dix. When they get one of the trucks moving, they say, it hadn't moved, you know, it stuck with me. Listening earlier on today, the truck hadn't moved for a long, long time, you know, there's something just really dramatic about that.
Yeah, I think so. The fact, you know, it takes forever to sort of start, and there's all the sort of, you know, narration about the spluttering and coughing of the engine, and everybody worries the Daleks are going to notice. I think there's some really nice bits in that scene where, you know, they're scared the Daleks are going to notice them. And, yeah, I think those sort of bits of the dust cut, you know, the sort of tension is good in the later bits of the book, I think.
Yes, it really gives you that sense of decay and the desperate situation all of humanity finds itself in.
And that's the whole point of the Daleks, I think, most of the time, that, you know, it's them against us, and humanity normally suffers. If you look, you know, all the great sort of Dalek stories, that sort of themes there, I think.
Sort of halfway through the book, we get a bit of a Grimm's fairy tale element with the two female characters in the cottage in the countryside.
Yeah, that bit's a bit interesting, because you've got those sort of, I don't know if it's meant to be for comedy or sort of nasty comedy, but I think you get those sort of two women who, you know, are in the countryside and are not expecting anything from the Daleks, and then they sort of very nastily get killed off.
And do you know, it's one of those ones, you've seen this story a number of times, you know that they're going to double-cross our heroes, but, you know, you do get that sense in the writing that they are up to something, aren't they? You know, Dix puts in the little lines like, oh, you know, she looked away as she said something to Susan.
Yeah, there's this sort of, you know, you can see it coming, little things. Really nicely done by Terrence, I think.
Yes, those little telltale signs of deception.
Yeah, they're sort of there very quickly, and you know that they're going to get their comeuppance at some point. But I think that little scene with the fairy tales, it's meant to sort of, you know, after the dystopian sort of nastiness of central London, I think it's meant to add a bit of relief, I think.
And then it heads more or less to all-out action in the end, and we get a good humane part of the story, don't we, when one of the freedom fighters recognises his brother has become a Roboman, and he actually attacks him, and then stays behind to buy Ian Chesterton some more time.
Yeah, that works really nicely, I think, but, you know, the whole tension gets ranked up and ranked up to the big invasion base, and you've got this guy who's been looking for his brother for the whole book, basically. He finds it and he turns on it. It's quite nasty in some way, but I think quite good, because it gives, as we said, it gives, you know, time for other people to, you know, survive and escape, really.
Yes, Doctor Who, full of those characters, you know, get a brief moment of screen time, very likeable, and they end up making the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah, I think that is all the way through really good Doctor Who stories. I think, you know, I've been watching Ark in Space, and I think that character is very close to the sort of Noah character in that, I think.
Oh yes, absolutely. And I was reminded of a character called Mrs. Mort in the David Tennant Cyberman two-parter. And
Yeah, she was great in that. She sort of does, you know, gives up her life, doesn't she, for the, you know, so everybody else can live, basically.
And a bit of sad news: we lost that actress last week here in Swansea, Helen Griffin. She passed away.
I think she was at Regen one.
Yeah,
sure, we met her.
She did a panel at least once with Margaret John, of course, who was in Gavin and Stacey.
That's the one I saw her at, and I met her at, that was the one I did meet her. So I thought I'd met her, and I saw the name, unfortunately. So very nice woman.
Yeah, very well-known actress in Wales. Appeared in the Keeping Faith series with Eve Miles, which is getting a national BBC showing from this week recently. That was one of her last roles, so, you know, may she rest in peace.
Do you know what time that's getting shown? Because it had no audio description on the BBC iPlayer. So when's that actually getting a live showing of Keeping Faith? It's making it brilliant.
I saw it advertised for this coming Thursday, which I think will be...
Is that daytime or evening time?
No, Thursday the 12th at 9 p.m, I think.
9 p.m, I'll be watching that, because it's making it really good.
Yeah, I've not seen it myself, but met Eve a number of times. Was actually in a Torchwood convention last year on the weekend before she started filming that show, and she was very excited about it, and it's been so great to see her get the success of it now, and it getting put on the national BBC.
Yeah, it's meant to be very good. It's got good reviews. Well, I think there's a lot of connections throughout Doctor Who, where, you know, you get these great characters. You sort of see them there for a bit, and then they sort of either get killed or do something to, you know, so everybody else survives. And I think, as we just said, there's a great one in Ark in Space. There's a great one in the David Tennant period. They're sort of all open. I think they're a good essential part of Who, I think.
And then you think of characters when they compare themselves to the Doctor, and in the new series particularly, it's been commented upon by villains mainly that the Doctor does leave a lot of collateral damage in his wake, and always has done.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way they've sort of flipped around, you know, because, you know, with the last episode of, you know, Twice Upon a Time, you know, the last Capaldi episode, that was the whole thing about those crystal women, that he was the Doctor of Blood, and having to show what he wasn't really. So I think it sort of has flipped around to showing maybe the Doctor's consequences, really.
Yes, and moving towards the end of the book, Al, we get a lovely uprising by the humans, Leading to a very dramatic end scene, which has been, the dialogue has been changed a bit by Terence Dix in the end, but he writes more as you can on the page to do with the, you know, character's physical emotions as well as emotional emotions, I suppose.
Well, yeah, this is the great thing about Terence's target books. As we all know, there's a lot of the final episodes in Doctor Who where it either gets squished or gets stopped, or, you know, things happen, so it has to all be sped up, and we never get a good ending. And Terence has a habit of making that bit put back. He normally does really good ending. And I think, yeah, this book has a nice ending. It sort of tidies everything up nicely, I think.
He does strip it back to one extent, because we don't get the whole "one day I shall come back" speech. We get that iconic line. We get "one day I shall come back." Gives some advice which is very prominent now with the new series. He actually says "be kind to Susan and David," which of course is one of Capaldi's last lines as the Doctor, I noticed. And he also mentions that life on Earth can be an adventure too, which was a central theme of the Sarah Jane Adventure spin-off.
There seems to be a habit of using stuff from other people's things. I noticed that the first line from Twice Upon a Time, you know, "I am the Doctor," is the first thing Tom Baker actually says to the Brigadier. So there seems to be a habit of stealing other lines from other places in Doctor Who. But I think, yeah, that those sort of ethoses of Doctor Who were put in this episode, being kind, you know, never treat people wrong. And that was definitely shown brilliantly when Peter Capaldi regenerated into Jodie, I think.
I think the writer's phrase is paying homage, Al. Not stealing, but...
No, it's paying homage. That's what we say. We're not stealing, we're paying homage.
We're not paying you any of our cash for borrowing your lines.
As I said, I was watching the Blu-ray of Robot, and I went, hang on, I know those first two lines. I went, it's Twice Upon a Time, so they obviously nicked that from that.
And as we say at the start of this podcast, Al, a great Time Lord once said, yeah, there's no point in being childish if you can't be grown up some of the time, or the other way around, even.
So, of course, we have the rather good audiobook of this story, read by William Russell. I think it's a very good reading by him. He seems to get all the characters right. You know, he sort of does Susan, he does Barbara very well, I think. And the actual other characters had great voices. And I think the soundscape was just about right. I was wondering if that was Nick Briggs doing the Daleks. I expect it was. So what did you think of it, Mike?
Yes, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't Nick. I do believe it was. I think this is one of three initial releases, maybe as far back as 2005. And certainly the soundscape wasn't at all invasive. It put the right sounds in at the right moments without overdoing them. As you said, I thought his voices were very well differentiated throughout. Sometimes felt, I know he's an elderly man himself, Ian, but the Roboman voices were just a tiny fraction too drawn out. They sounded very, very drowsy rather than robotically controlled.
Yeah, I would say the same about the Robo voices. They were very slow and slow. It didn't sound quite right, in my opinion. And even if you're controlled, you might have some still sense. I thought they were a bit too dazed. Otherwise, I think it's a really good reading. I think it's about the second time I've heard it, because I think they had it on Radio 4 Extra when it was the 50th anniversary, and that was really good listening. And I think it's a good listen. It's one of William Russell's really good readings, which he does very well at that period.
Yes, we have a few more to cover from him, and still doing well, of course, still attending conventions in his early 90s. There was a lovely moment on Instagram a few months ago when William had come to Cardiff for the day to do Cardiff Comic Con, and Russell T. Davies was on the same train going back to London for the premiere of his very English Scandal show. And the first time he ever got to meet the first companion, and they had a wonderful photo together, and it just seemed like one of those moments where the stars aligned for Doctor Who fandom. It was a great moment.
Yeah, well, I've seen that Instagram photo as well, and it just looks, you know, he just looks so happy to be next to, you know, William Russell, you know, sort of Ian Cheston. That's going for RTD's mind in that photo, and it's just amazing, because, as you know, he's in his 90s, and he doesn't seem to be slowing down any way, I think. He's like, you know, it's like my grandfather is in his 90s, and he don't seem to slow down at all, you know, that sort of intelligent and sort of working on things still. He does a lot of reading, I think, still for Big Finish, I think. They still, with their companion thing, I think they do.
And I'm going to say, hats off to him. He has a son in his 30s who's an actor now. Alfred Enoch has appeared in an episode of Sherlock as a murdered soldier a few years ago. Appeared in the Harry Potter films as well. So, hats off to William becoming a dad. It must have been in his 50s or 60s.
Yeah, he must have been, because he's 90 now. So it's in his 30s. It's about that. Well, it's I know who you mean now. I mean, he's really good. He was good in Sherlock and good in the Harry Potter films. It's like,
Yeah, needs that sort of bigger break, I think, you know, but I think he's definitely one to see more of in the future.
I think so. I don't think I've met William Russell or not. I don't think I have yet.
Yes, I met him at a Big Finish Day a few years ago.
I think that's
Windsor.
The one I didn't go to, because he wasn't at the first one I went to. I think I know I want to meet him at some point. So that list of people, if I don't meet them soon, I'm not going to be able to meet them. I think, you know, like you've got David Bradley, and I've still got to meet Tom.
Well, I was being a bit silly with William Russell. I sort of said hello, Chesterton, when I met him, and he sort of gave a semi-laugh, you know, like, oh, goodness, not one of these ones.
Not
again.
Another one.
No, he was a very nice man.
Some people on that period of the companions don't mind it, and some do, I suppose. You know, I've met like you, I've met Annika and Fraser a lot, and they seem to go along with it, I think.
I mean, the stereotypical one is the episode of Father Ted, isn't it, where Ted sees Richard Wilson, and he ends up slapping him for saying, "I don't believe it."
Though I've met Richard Wilson, and the temptation was there. I thought, no, I'm not doing it. The temptation's always there, and it's like, I won't do it.
He has been announced now for Comic Con in London, so I may end up getting his autograph, and I'll probably end up quoting his doctor from The Empty Child.
I'd go and see him. He's very friendly. He's very nice to meet, basically. He took my hand. You know, I was talking to Matt Lucas at the time, but it was, you know, he was next to him. So we must, of course, discuss the great covers for this book. They're sort of legendary, and they're done by the sort of best people, I think. Didn't you say it was Chris Kalaman? I can pronounce his surname, so I'll let you pronounce it.
Chris Achilleos, yes.
Thank you, Achilleos, that's it. And they look lovely if it's done by him. So what's it like?
An utterly iconic one, Al. One of my favourites. Iconic and also slightly evocative now. We don't have the Doctor on there, you know, which we have criticised some Target covers for before, but we have the Doctor Who in orange, sort of Tom Baker era logo, with a curved banner on top, and the Dalek invasion of Earth, Terence Dix against the grey London sky, London lit up at night, Big Ben, the face of it lit up by a spaceship going past, which is very similar to the one crashed by the pig in Aliens of London, which is more of a future reference at the moment. We have the Dalek itself, bathed in sort of the moonlight, the early sunset, I'd say, within a white sort of explosive bubble. We have a Roboman dressed up looking like they're a member of the SAS or a very sort of dark set of forces. The Houses of Parliament, the spires sticking up in the background, another explosion in there. Just superb, Al. One of my very favourites, I think. Superb from Chris Achilleos.
Really nice. I think that you don't need the Doctor. I think it works with all that sort of imagery of London and the sort of background and the sort of Daleks coming at you. I think that works really well. And that sort of must be in their minds when they were doing, you know, the invasion of Earth, the Chris Eccleston story, I think.
And then I think, was it the Virgin books, Al, in the 90s, 1990?
Yeah, but if it's 1990s, it'll be Virgin.
A bit more of a stripped back one from Alistair Pearson. The black banner of space with the Sylvester McCoy logo. The Dalek invasion of Earth in white prominent writing, slightly smaller, based on a Doctor Who adventure first broadcast in 1964. Terence Dix at the bottom of the Dalek base against a white background. Just the picture of Big Ben, just a white background. Hartnell within a white bubble with Carol Ann Ford, Susan beneath him. Yes, a bit more minimalistic, but I think a good effort by Alistair, but
It's nice, but I think I prefer the first one. I don't think it needs the Doctor really on the cover, this one.
No, Chris Achilleos, I think, certainly takes the top prize for that one, and that was recreated for the audiobook release from November 2009. So, yeah, that was reproduced, and it's a very good reproduction.
Well, that's fantastic, because that one does look nice on an iPad. I had a look at that earlier. But was that one actually, you know, when you went to the exhibition, was that actually one on show as a large print, that cover?
It hasn't sprung to mind, Al. I don't think it was, but if people
that'd
can
be
get
great.
Onto
that'd
us,
be great as a large sort of, you know, A4 poster. That would be great, as I think.
If you can let us know if that was at the Target exhibition at the Cartoon Museum in London back in 2016, let us know at DWTargetFiles on Twitter.
Yeah, that'd be great, because I think that looks beautiful as a sort of big sort of A4 poster. That would look really nice. So I think, yeah, I definitely think the first one is better than the second one, maybe because, you know, the second one has too much. I don't think you need Susan and the Doctor on it, I think. Well, yeah, we need to, of course, score this book and TV episodes, and I think, and the audiobook, of course. I think it's a very good, well-written book. It's quite tight when, you know, he's having to deal with a ginormous six-part episode, and it deals well with the characters, it deals well with the Daleks. It has that nice payoff of leaving of a companion at the end. Spoilers there. So I'd probably give the book about an 8 because I really enjoyed it. And the same with the audiobook, because I think William Russell's performance is great, and it's nice performance. He does all the Doctor's voice and the companions well, and yeah, it's very enjoyable. I haven't seen the TV episodes for a while, but when I last saw them, I think they're good, but I think the score would have to be about a 6 for them, I think, just for the fact there's probably too many episodes. I think it would work better as a 4-episode story instead of a 6. So overall, I think it's a really good listen. You'll enjoy it. It's got a good performance, and I think the book has nice pace to it, I think, and good explosions and invasions and good payoff, I think.
Yes, I think possibly if we're doing the TV versions from memory, I haven't rewatched for this review. Possibly as low as a 6, because it's a very, very slow pace, but obviously it has that wonderful 2 moments of drama, one with the Dalek emerging from the Thames and the iconic speech at the end, so perhaps a 6 or 7 for that. Certainly within the narrative, Terence Dix has definitely tightened the story, I think. Used all his narrative skills and his literary skills to add great tension and a better pace to the novelisation. So I'd go for an 8 for the novel. And I think William Russell has elevated Dix's words again and David Whittaker's originally, and the soundscape is very good, so I'll probably give the audiobook a 9, I think, Al.
Well, that's great, because I think the book and the audiobook are very good, I think, so it's well worth a listen and read. If you've got nothing to do on a nice summary day at the moment, it's very worth a listen and read, I think.
Yes, and as often happens, Al, when we get into this recording, there's something I wanted to mention earlier on, and I'll bring it up again now. I did mention at the beginning whether this story seems very dramatic, or the Doctor is sort of stripped back away from the action a little bit, just to give Susan more prominence in the story towards the end. I'm not sure at the time of the TV filming in 1964, it was because William Hartnell famously was ill or had a holiday in between, and there is actually a shot of a double of him, which was used for a few stories in that time. But I think perhaps Terence Dix has taken that 15 years later when he wrote the novel and used it to re-enhance the independence of Susan. Second or third or fourth story, maybe in the second series of Doctor Who, you know, had she really developed that much independence throughout the first series run? I can't honestly recall.
There are moments of independence in the first season, you know, where you get to meet Susan and, you know, how she deals with the Daleks and all that in the first season. I don't think it's a great deal. I think this is sort of maybe she had enough or wanted to leave or so. I think I do agree, though, the way they write the Doctor is very interesting, because he's very sort of not, you know, the action here, he's not in the front role. He's sort of very sideline. I think in the book it works, because it gives more room for the companions to have a bigger part, and it has, you know, parts of room where, you know, the sort of survivors would have probably allowed the Doctor to do everything, and they would have, you know, to help more, where the survivors have more of a say and more of a role, I think. But yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think, like you, I think Susan is one of those sort of first good companions, but I don't think she should have left her. I think there was more room to develop, and I think, you know, the sort of little bits what she's done for Big Finish for that character have developed it a bit more. But I don't know. I've always liked Susan, but I don't know if she really did enough, really. She's sort of the starting point for, you know, better ones to come, I think.
And, you know, the Doctor does get his own character development in the book in terms of letting her go, doesn't he?
Granddaughter sort of connection, what there is with her and with him and Susan. I mean, and yeah, it's a very interesting, because the way it's done is beautifully written. And I think, you know, it allows Susan to go, basically, and have her life.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Who's News, and it's Alex here on July the 6th. Well, first thing we have to mention is that though we only have 10 episodes for the new season, and it was rumoured there was going to be no Christmas episode, there is now rumours sort of leaking that there will be a Christmas episode due to the fact that it has appeared on one of the old Doctor Who directors' IMDb page, and that is Wayne Yip, the person who directed The Emperor of Mars and other episodes from Peter Capaldi's last season. So it's looking very promising that there is going to be a Christmas special set for it this year, but nothing has been confirmed by the BBC yet, so we can hope. After the excitement of a first scene from Jodie's first season of Doctor Who was unfortunately to the BBC leaked online, they have now decided to set a legal cease and summons on the company Reddit who released it online. They are employing top high-flying lawyers in Hollywood, because that's where the Cloud Company were based, who leaked the one-minute very good scene of Jodie's first episode, and are applying all legal pressure to show that the BBC does not allow any form of leaks. Well, from BigFinish.com this week, we have the release of their version of Callum. This was a sort of spy drama on ITV in the UK. It has now been re-invited as a drama at BigFinish.com, with Ben Miles playing Callum, and his sidekick being played by the great comedian Frank Skinner. Also has Nick Briggs in as Hunter, their boss. He's very spy. If you can imagine the Avengers, while a little bit darker, then you'll be in the right area. It's a 4-disc box set and has 4 great stories in it. Something rather special coming from BigFinish.com is the fact they are dipping their toe into the Star Trek world. Coming later this year, it will be Star Trek Prometheus, 4 short audiobooks based on actual books that have been released in the past. They are going to be read by Alec Newman, who was also in Enterprise and has also done stuff for Dark Shadows with BigFinish.com. If you want to know where the actual reference to Prometheus is, it's mentioned in a Star Trek Voyager episode called Ship in the Bottle. And these are going to be books discussing and showing what happened with Star Trek Prometheus. Well, we have media recommendations at the moment. I listened to the new Bullet for My Valentine album, which is very good. Been watching the Tom Baker Blu-ray box set of his first season, which looks stunning. It was well worth a month's wait because the it's all been redone and looks great. TV-wise, I've also been watching the hilarious Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse Go Fishing, which is great fun. So what have you been watching? Also, the World Cup I've been keeping a great eye on.
Yes, watch the World Cup, pal. The Colombia game, very exciting. Well done, England. And quarter final tomorrow, of course, against the Swedes. We've just seen France go through, haven't we?
Yeah, they went through 2-0 against Uruguay, which is interesting because you think you always knew the French were probably going to go through, but Uruguay were looking quite good. And that England match was great, sitting there getting the penalties and thinking, oh God, we're not going to win against penalties. And we did, which was great, you know, very good. And I think we've got a fair chance against Sweden tomorrow, I think.
Oh, yes, just a week to go, folks, and, you know, if England are in the final, perhaps they're...
It will jinx it. I haven't said it, because it will, you know... But I hope so.
I did say if, and, you know, it'd be nice if Auntie Beeb would give us a Doctor Who trailer then at halftime.
Well, it has to come, because it's either going to be there, or it'll be at the end of the Wimbledon final like last time. I think it should be there, either of those two places, I think. Because it's ready. It's all, you know, as we know from the leaks, it's the footage from episode 1 to 3 is done. And, you know, there's enough controversy out there as there is for it, you know, because everybody's moaning about the sonic screwdrivers he's got and everything.
And they have actually confirmed now, Al, that San Diego Comic-Con, 2 weeks on Thursday, that'll be the 26th of July, they're going to have the panel there with Jodie, with Chris Chibnall, with Mandip Kaul, and, Mandip Gill is the new lady companion, and Tosin Cole, the new male companion.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because I always get those names wrong. Yeah, what I've seen of those two from that leak, which we shouldn't have watched what we did, they are looking very good. And I think the fact, you know, you see them for about 2 minutes in that clip, and you already know an awful lot about them works. So that'll be interesting. Can you actually watch that panel if you're in the UK or anywhere?
Nothing announced as of yet, Al. Certainly, I know New York Comic Con, which is held in the autumn.
That last year had live YouTube.
But but I'm not sure if San Diego does. You know, there are, not encouraged folks, but there are ways and means of, you know, you can follow Twitter and other social media at the time when people are answering certain questions.
There'll be somewhere saying it, or, you know, people there will sneak their iPhone in and record it.
But it's building up nicely, folks, just a few months away from new Doctor Who now. I expect the premieres will be announced soon. Well, and
you know, the thing we haven't mentioned here is the new composer.
Of course, Segun Akinola. Now, it was, I think, the evening after we released our last episode last week.
It was, because you texted me in. I've, like you, have never heard of him. I checked his stuff out on SoundCloud. The stuff he does is very sort of, I think, very close to Mark Ayres, 80s late stuff, I think.
I think it was a great mix.
It's really good, but it's not who I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be Blair... I don't even remember his name, you know what I mean, from does all the Torchwood and stuff for Big Finish.
No, I don't know if he's one who came out of the blue, but very talented. If you go to his SoundCloud page, folks, I think Segun Akinola.
It's a weird pronunciation, but just when you get SoundCloud, the search when he's there, all his stuff's there, and it's very instrumental, it's very sort of electronic. I know there's a bit of Jean-Michel Jarre, I'd say, but it's a very interesting pick, because he hasn't really... Well, except for doing short films for the BBC and stuff like that, he hasn't really done much. Well, I think that's the sort of situation Murray Gold was in when he started. He wasn't as known as he is now.
Yes, and some great African harmonies there from the British and Black series he did recently, earlier this year. And we know that certainly one of the Doctor Who episodes is probably going to be set in South Africa, so he might have that sort of vibe given to that episode.
Maybe Black Panther sort of tribal film music to it, I think.
Quite possibly, Al. And other media recommendations-wise, I've been catching up with the 80s series Airwolf on Five Spike Channel here in the UK. I've recorded a lot of those, and I'm really now into a series called The Goldbergs. Have you watched that, Al?
What's that? I don't think I have watched that.
It's set, written by a man called Adam Goldberg, who's in his 40s now, and it's based on his life when he used to go around his American family with a video camera in the 80s, and it's set
back... I think I have seen it. It's a bit Mick Broomfield-ish, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, you know, sort of described online as our generation who grew up in the 80s, our sort of version of the Wonder Years, really.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. You're that,
but it's very comedy-based, and it's very stylistically a look back at the 80s, and as somebody sort of messed around with a video camera myself, it's quite evocative, really, but, you know, very American, but full of all the great pop culture influences of the 80s.
It must be worth a look. Have you seen the Patrick Stewart rumour?
Yes, quite possibly he's returning as Picard, and also this week it's been announced that there's a script for a Quentin Tarantino potentially directed Star Trek film, and it does have, apparently, Zachary Quinto Spock in it, in that script, so
that could be interesting. I think, who just said it recently, Simon Pegg's basically said he was still up for playing Scotty, so it'll be an interesting one.
Al, if you'd like to recommend any sort of other podcasts at the moment, I've listened to Smirsh Pod, the James Bond film. They've done a side special based on other films that James Bond production and actors have been in, and they've done Hell Drivers this weekend, which also, of course, features William Hartnell in a late 50s role, a young Sean Connery, young Stanley Baker, young Patrick McGoohan, so looking forward to listening to that one.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Podcast-wise, I've been, of course, listening to the side project of Mr. Nick Briggs, which is from his own production company, Red Rocket Productions, which is the Nick and Benji show. Sort of deals with cult TV. It picks a different one each week for them to discuss, and they've done stuff like The Quatermass and Where's All Gummidge and UFO, all sort of Gerry Anderson stuff, because they're sponsored by Gerry Anderson's shop, the online shop, basically, and you know, because of James Anderson working for Big Finish, he's good friends for him now, so that's very funny. I've been listening to the Chittister podcast. It's from the Chittister Festival, because Matt's in a play I'm getting to see there at the moment, Matt Lucas, that is, and I'm hoping I'll do an interview for that. That's always a good one. So I think in general, mainly Doctor Who related, I've added the Scarrow 3 one.
Yes, Al. Trial of a Time Lord podcast is also an excellent Doctor Who one. Going back, and usually have a case for the defence, and you have a case for the prosecution of the guys who are trying to get through every Doctor Who story, but it's a very, very funny podcast, that.
I have to try that. I haven't tried it. I'm trying to think of the other one. It's the Star Wars one I normally do. It is the... not the one you just did. The Star Wars Council one, I think.
Okay, Blah Wars I listen to. That's another funny one.
Yeah, that's the one you just do, which is really good. We're in a very interesting time, I think, with the Star Wars films. I mean, what I've been seeing and reading online with the whole way Film 9's going.
Yeah, and a little bit frustrated at the moment. There's only a week of the World Cup left, but Ant-Man sequel, Ant-Man and the Wasp, has come out in America, but we have to wait another month because they've been...
We'll wait till August for that. We've got the Incredibles 2, which is out next Friday. It might be fun.
Yeah, and Mission Impossible 6, I think, is out.
Is it 6 or 7? It's one of those now. I just want to see it to see how nuts Tom Cruise is when he does that air jump seat, you know, what nearly killed him. I want to see how it comes out.
Shattered his foot, yeah.
Well, he did break his foot in about three places by doing it. I want to see how that comes out, because it sort of doesn't completely show it in the trailer. It sort of shows a bit of it, and you just think, you're insane. Why didn't you get a stunt double to do that?
Well, he did the plane stunt himself as well, didn't he? Strapped to the side, so...
Yeah. Basically, the mad two stunts in this new MI film are all Tom Cruise. He never uses a stuntman. I expect there's some mad stunts in the new Top Gun film he's filming, which will be just as nuts, probably.
Yeah, no real desire to see that. I'm not a huge fan of the first one. I find it a little bit boring.
Yeah, I didn't actually see it at the time, but it's very lovey, isn't it? It's very fun. It's quite fun, I think, these days, Top Gun. But I think the one he did recently was where he was a pilot again. Is that American?
I've not seen it. The Drugs Runner.
Yeah, that one is actually better, I think. That was quite good because of the history base in that. That was quite good. Keep saying here, we need people to lovely, hopefully, review and star our podcast on iTunes because it's getting no reviews.
Yes, please, faithful listeners. We're getting some good figures, but some reviews would be very kindly accepted. Thank you.
Because on iTunes, you can see the star rating, I might mention, people, and we're on about 0.1, and we want to be on 5!
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, we'll be discussing Mordrin Undead, written by Peter Grimwade, along with the audiobook, performed by David Collings. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for our podcast page and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, Dalek Invasion of Earth Review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. 12th Doctor Theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, Dalek Invasion of Earth Review was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK and Exeter, Devon, England, UK during July 2018.